In the era of lockdowns and pandemics, we haven't had many, if any, opportunities to take our show on the road, and we've missed it. Our last live show was in October 2019 at the American Folk Art Museum in New York City. We're restless. We're hungry. So when the invitation came to travel to Aspen, Colorado for the opening of a new Andy Warhol show at the Aspen Art Museum, we jumped at the opportunity. Andy Warhol, Lifetimes, is a career-spanning show which originated at the Tate Modern, featuring his most famous works alongside a plethora of lesser-known and equally fascinating pieces of ephemera. The show takes a new look at a life that seemed, at least to this outsider, fully examined. How wrong I was. In an innovative and surprising turn, the Aspen Art Museum invited Los Angeles-based artist Monica Maioli to reconceptualize the presentation of the exhibition. The results are invigorating. What follows is a conversation recorded in front of an audience on the show's opening weekend and featuring the aforementioned Monica Maioli, assistant curator Simone Krug, and the museum's director, Nicola Lees. The show runs through March 27, 2022. Aspen is the only U.S. venue. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. I'd like to begin at kind of the 50,000 foot level with Nicola and talk about the fact that you began your journey as director here at the museum, like right at the onset of the pandemic, literally days before things shut down. You know, the opening of this has been such a jubilant, joyful thing with this show. Does it feel like some kind of culmination of the work you've been doing these last 18 months to 2 years?
It has been quite a journey. I'm just so grateful to the community for helping welcome me at such a strange moment in the world, and the board and National Council also for being so supportive and giving me so much guidance. I think I was meant to start April 6th, 2020, and I think the day my visa came through, you might hear my British accent. And we closed the museum on March 13th. I really met most people, all the team, on Zoom, which was a new thing, Zoom before I got this job. And I had a very clear vision when I went through the interview process. And I feel like that vision in many ways didn't really change, but it's something that has gone more in depth. And it feels like there's a meaning to how we've been trying to restructure and reorganize, as many museums have. Vision really was about working with artists in every aspect of everything we do. We're a contemporary art museum without a collection. And we really want to create a space that's about discourse and dialogue. We have an incredible artist who's hiding around the corner as well, called Jonathan Berger, who came in to do one of the first projects on my arrival, which was the store downstairs. And it's this really magical and very democratic space where you can touch most of the things in the store, not everything. You can buy them $5 to $50,000, and the whole store really is an artwork. Jonathan's been with us for the last 18 months, really helping us think through how we can change the institution and change the conversations we're having about what we feel like art can do. And Precious Okomoyan's garden, which is behind us again, has been an 18-month project. You know, Aspen is a very seasonal place, so the garden has changed every season. And for us, having artists kind of be with us in this space and create work in the museum, the sculptures we made with Precious in the basement of the museum, with the crew experimenting with concrete at 11 p.m. at night. And I think Sam Harvey, I'm not sure if Sam Harvey's here today, but a local artist and gallerist was here helping us. And it really felt like there were those really magical moments. And of course, we hope there'll be many more as we grow as an institution. But those dialogues also brought me to Andy Warhol. When Tate Modern phoned me up and were asking if we would be interested in joining the retrospective, and, you know, my first thoughts, I have to say, was how can we do an Andy Warhol show after Donna DeSalvo's amazing exhibition at the Whitney Museum? And having spent the last 4 years in New York, it seemed impossible. It was a big risk. for us at a time when everything else we were doing was about reducing risk and keeping everyone safe and happy and healthy. But at the same time, you know, I was reading this incredible book by Dean Sobel, who's one of the original directors of the museum. He was here, and he wrote this incredible book called One Hour Ahead. And that was the book, once I read it, I sort of understood Aspen. I was like, what is this One Hour Ahead? How could Aspen be in a different time zone to us? But I loved it, and it really taught me this story of artists coming to Aspen from 1945 to 2004. And we recently found out that Andy Warhol had a show in Aspen in the 1950s. This was something we found out from his most recent biographer, Blake. And he didn't come to Aspen in the 50s. It was a touring show of his graphic illustrations. But the story we really knew was the story from the 80s and him coming here in 81 and 82, 83. And he was in the first exhibition at the old Aspen Art Museum in 1979. He had a big retrospective at the Denver Art Museum in 1978. And also had a solo show with 1984. So it was a way to retell that story of artists being the sort of driving force of this institution, which was the reason I came.
So Monica, you're primarily known for your work as an artist, but you also do curatorial work. You have a show at the Hammer right now, for example. But bringing in an artist to kind of revision a show like this, it's kind of radical. It's not something you see all the time. How did you get involved with this? What was the first call like, or email, or how were you approached for this?
Well, it was actually the director of Buchholz Gallery called me and said that Nicola had called and was interested in my visualizing this exhibition, this survey exhibition on Andy Warhol's work that had come from the Tate. And of course, I was sitting in my car outside of a Thai restaurant and I was completely floored. And immediately said, "Oh my God, what an opportunity to take on, or to not just to take on, but to be in relationship to Warhol's work, because he was an artist that for me was always in the front of my mind. And it's not just because Warhol is a part of daily lives; it's that there's certain works of Warhol's that are always in the front of my mind. And so, I just thought this was going to be an amazing and kind of incomprehensible experience of intimacy with an artist that I would never have imagined being able to be in conversation with in this way. And I was very excited about the idea of being closer to Andy's work and having a new experience that I never could have even fantasized about. And Nicola made that really real for me by just allowing me to do whatever I wanted and opening up the floodgates in terms of, you know, there was essentially no budget as far as I was. I said, "What's the budget for the show?" And she was like, "Oh, sorry. I'm sure there was a budget." But what she said was important, which was, "Don't you think about that. I'll worry about that. And just do your fantasy." And so it allowed me to create something that I never would have thought to do. It allowed me complete freedom. And the museum, in a sense, provided this it's corny to say a canvas, but it provided a canvas and a way to interact with Andy Warhol in a way, in whatever way I imagined.
So Simone was so kind to give me a unplanned, impromptu tour of the exhibition. It started out by just saying, "I'm going to show you a few things," and then we ended up going through all the galleries, and it was fantastic yesterday, so thank you for that, first of all. But, you know, you were on the ground here doing a lot of the day-to-day work, of course, and working with Monica. I'm assuming you were working a lot, mostly remotely, mostly through email and everything else. But you were here doing that work. Where do you start, right? So you have this show coming in from the Tate. You're charged with the idea of taking it in a slightly new direction, adding to it. What's the first kind of entry point into that change?
I think one of the things we spoke a lot about was how this show, no matter what, would be different in the United States. The show originated in London, it traveled to Cologne, and from there went to Toronto. And no matter what, you know, in the United States, it would be something completely, different.
It had been kind of the same thing up until now, right? Like it was not changed at the other venues the way it was here. And maybe Nicola, I'm not sure this could be for you. When you're dealing with an institution like the Tate, for example, who put the work into doing it a certain way, how do they react when you say, "Hey, I'm gonna change this some"? You know, is that something that's difficult to broach, or are they open to it? How do you get that going?
I think they really mentored us, I think. And we wouldn't have been able to do this show without the museums. The incredible work that it takes to put a retrospective like this, and also relates a lot to the collections and all the other work that those kind of bigger institutions are doing. We're much more nimble. We can think differently and think on our feet. But it was quite an interesting conversation to bring into the mix, because we'd already started working together because we really wanted to know how we felt about it, and thinking sort of long term and also thinking very historically. And when we wanted it to be about a conversation between two artists, and one of the artists is here and with us and alive, and the other artist is in the building. And for us, we wanted it to connect to Aspen. We wanted to tell our own story. And I'm excited that I feel like that's something that really has happened. And a few people have come who saw the Tate show. And you know, it's infinitely fascinating to look at a Warhol show, but they've really seen all the subtle things Monica have brought to the table.
We've done, 80-odd episodes of this podcast, and we've never done one on Andy Warhol. And I've kind of resisted it a little bit because early on it felt like the easy thing to talk about because it's so ubiquitous in our culture. And I was kind of waiting for the right thing. So when I got the invitation to come do this and started understanding and reading about what you were doing with that, it was kind of the first time I thought, you know, this could be something where we could talk a little bit differently about it. Monica, I'm interested to know, you mentioned, you know, Warhol's been part of your kind of subconscious even for decades.
Yeah.
What did you kind of think you knew about him and his work? And I'm curious, is it totally changed after having gone through the process, or is it more a reconfirmation of what you expected already?
Well, my relationship to Warhol as a man was quite probably what almost everybody's, I mean, I don't know, maybe others have had a deeper relationship to reading biographies and things like that. I had never, of course I was aware of things, but things that would come up generally, so like if he was a devout Catholic, the fact that he lived with his mother and he had a very close relationship with his mother, things like that, that over the years I had discovered about Warhol, but I was more interested, of course, in his work. And I think for me, the real joy was getting to know him as a person and wanting that to be part of the show. Because I can't really, I'm somebody who deals a lot with relationships in my work and with intimacy and sexuality, but also just with attachment. And so I knew that for me, I would have to approach this with the same feeling of attachment. And that required for me a kind of intimacy with Warhol's life, his and stories, and finding out as much as I could about him.
And you know, speaking of sexuality, I was thinking, you know, the show does take on kind of the concept of queerness. And it made me have to rethink about how I thought and perceived Warhol. And I thought of him much more in an androgynous sense and kind of removed from sexuality. Mm-hmm. He was someone who is quite obviously a gay man. It's not hidden in the work, but in my mind, I'd kind of separated him from that. And this show kind of has made me think about his relation to sexuality in a new way, especially that really beautiful intimate room that deals with some of his nudes and portraits, mm-hmm. but also even the space dealing with drag and
yes.
some of those other components.
Yeah, that's probably the most complicated room in a sense, because Warhol's relationship to that material was that he kept it, he didn't sell that material. It wasn't shown. I mean, he did show, and of course, the torso paintings, and that was exhibited and that was sold. Mm-hmm. But much of the work that you see in that was research material, was source material. He shot 50 different men. And he used only a handful for his torso series. So the work is very explicit. The lithographs is very obviously the most explicit work that he made. But he did keep those in the studio, and you know, those weren't commercially sold works in that sense. So I had a certain kind of problem to solve in the sense of, how do we make this public? How should this be made public? Should this stay private? Is that equal to Warhol's wishes? But I also understood that for him as a gay man, and maybe as a devout Catholic, and the ways that he dealt with acceptance, I suppose, maybe on his own sexuality through his work, that I felt that this was a pivotal room in the gallery. It had to be there, and it had to be, I would say, kind of celebratory, that one should be immersed in this world. And so those were a lot of the decisions that I had made, especially the more difficult decision, really, in terms of the blowing up of the Polaroids. Again, the question of scale. Warhol did, maybe jokingly, tongue-in-cheek, describe those as landscapes. So I thought I'd take him up on that and make them into a kind of a terrain. I thought, of course, that they were absolutely exquisite photographs as well.
To Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by museum coat rooms, sometimes referred to as cloak rooms by the more elite among us. Coat rooms provide space to store and hang, of course, coats, jackets, scarves, capes, if that is your thing, and other various outerwear, including cloaks, while we're at it, which are sort of like capes, but not quite the same thing. Anyway, we're keeping the wet, soggy, sometimes bulky or snow-covered articles away from the art. You don't want to carry it, and we certainly don't want you wearing it. Drop it in the coat room or the cloak room, and we'll take it from there.
What's fascinating to me is that seeing work that could easily, or certainly at one time, would have been labeled as pornographic, or not have been shown at all.
Yeah.
You go through the gallery, and maybe Simone or Monica, you can talk about this. There's still this inherent sweetness and earnestness and innocence to the work. There's not an aggressiveness to it, you know? And it made me think of him slightly differently.
There's an arm and a bicep. In some instances, there are faces. It's really about this deep love of the male form of bodies more generally, I think.
And beauty.
One of the incredible things about that series is that the Warhol Foundation distributed so many of Warhol's photographs, including that series, about 10 years ago. And so they're all in public collections and quite easy to source and to find. That was really incredible.
Yeah, that is really amazing that they did.
So they're in universities, and
yes,
so students can come and see those works.
Yeah, so they're alongside the celebrity portraits, et cetera. But I agree, there's such a beautiful sense of curiosity, a desire to know that you're describing, I think. And that sense of curiosity, that sense of, he just was such a genius. I mean, also, of course, into the way that he worked with form, the way he worked with materials. And one of my favorite things in the show, and one of the things that moves me the most, interestingly, turned out to be that video of him. I'm getting a little emotional talking about it. It's the video of him painting. It was something that we got for this show specifically. And when one of the joys of doing it, you have a very quiet relationship to works that you've known for a very long time, like being alone specifically for with the Marilyn diptych was very moving, or just all of that work, but to be alone in a space. And for me, I was just passing by the gallery and I saw that video had been mounted and I walked into it and it was just stunning, you know, just to watch him work. And it's such a quiet piece, but it's, you see him in real time painting and how he was thinking. And also the fact that, I don't know exactly, because he made multiples of things, but he appeared to be painting the portrait of Wilhelmina Ross, which is in the next room. So there were things like that that were unexpected. And so it's those deep, deep moments of being able to envision someone that you thought you knew, but you didn't know quite that way. You know, he was somebody, I've seen him taking photographs and Polaroids and things, but to watch him paint is something very special. And he's so at ease in a way, and you can sort of see him in his element, and I just found that so beautiful and moving.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing that. I think, you know, I can't remember it off the top of my head, but there's this psychological condition, I can't remember what the name of it is, but it's the idea that you become emotional, you know, when you're standing in front of a certain work of art. And I think someone like Warhol, because of the way pop culture has dealt with him, has always kind of had this cool coldness. You know, it's like the guy in the sunglasses, and he's wearing this layer of protective leather jacket and all these kind of things to keep the public away. But, you know, when you see someone, yeah, working, and you see them in that natural environment, that pureness. But thank you for sharing that. Nicola, I'm curious to know, growing up in the UK, Warhol is in some ways kind of the quintessential American artist in many ways. And I was wondering what your relationship to his work was growing up across the Atlantic in a different country. Did you understand his work there, the way you kind of understood it since you've seen the show or come over here or seen the Whitney exhibition? Because his work does seem linked with the American experience in so many ways.
I think seeing artists through other artists' eyes, and I think the Tate did an incredible Warhol show, I think 20 years ago when they opened Tate Modern, that show has sort of stayed with me that whole time. And that was really my main experience until I saw Donna.
So that was kind of an early moment for you to kind of
understand. It wasn't early enough, I'd say. But I think the thing that working with Monica, and this was a really true experience, is when we were talking about doing this show, we didn't really know what it was yet as well. And you know, there's a great relationship with the architecture of the building here, because the Tate 20 years ago was the first sort of year or so of Tate Modern, and those, it's a very, the space is organized in a very chronological way, you know, because they're the wings of this large building, you can sort of go from 1 to 10. And our building, it's more, it's stacked, sometimes like a cake. But and so we were forced to sort of deconstruct a chronology, even though I feel like we've kept a real rigorous sense of time in the show. And I think the title of the show is even called Warhol Lifetimes. So that sort of integrated the way we've been thinking. And as we were talking with the crew and the people, everyone that works in the museum, we were unpacking the works. And I think they were just in awe of what Monica had brought to a show that they thought they would know what was coming. And I think the truth was that none of us really knew what was going to, how it was going to feel until even probably yesterday at 4:45 p.m. But when we were talking initially, when I was talking to Nancy or Larry and Susan about whether we should really embark on this journey, this show, was actually just thinking about his relationship to Aspen. You know, we always say everyone has their own Warhol, but the images of Warhol and Aspen, he was also clearly very happy when he was here. The images of him smiling, he's on adventures. And I think there was something about that intimacy that telling the story in Aspen is very different to the story in New York or in Chicago or San Francisco. And you know, it's the beginning of that journey. We opened the show last night. So we've got days and months, yeah, even months to figure out what it's going to mean. And there's a magic to Aspen, this kind of way that you can think differently here. Time feels different here, the altitude. And that's it, clearly in the story in the 1 Hour Ahead book is why artists have come here again and again. Yeah, and I think for us, that's the kind of institution we want to build moving forward.
To that point, I'm curious to hear from each of you about this question, which is, the show is now open, that work is completed. This can be a personal take, this can be an institutional take, whatever you want to say, but how do you know if the show is a success or not? Because it can't be just based on attendance. You know, what metrics do you use personally to understand whether that's doing what you intended it to do on the outset when you first planned it?
This is a show I would want to see. I think this is a show that has so many different elements of surprise. We've spoken so many times about how everyone already knows Warhol, everyone already has their own Warhol. In the research process with Monica and with Nicola, I learned so much. There are so many new elements and new things about this person who blossomed and ballooned into an art superstar. There's just many, many different sides of this person, many different lives that you get to discover in this exhibition. From his early advertisements with shoes in Harper's Bazaar to clips from The Love Boat, that popular TV show, in 1985. And so I think this is a successful show because, you know, I think it caters to people who want to see the iconic, and it also caters to those coming to discover something new.
Monica, what's your metric?
Well, I think it's certainly, on a personal level, been incredibly satisfying for me. And it is a little weird to see people in the galleries because you've been living it and feeling it and dreaming about it, literally. It's so different to have a public in the galleries, and of course it's incredibly exciting. But I think why I think it's successful has to do, and I do think it is successful, with sensuality in a certain way. I feel like it's somewhat unknowable in a certain ways, which I find interesting. And it's a kind of characteristic, I think, of creating something. And I feel that when I'm in the galleries. I understand that it works, but there's always that kind of thing that happens with an art piece, that unknowability, that sense of mystery. I think that the show has that. And certainly the response has been very positive. And so I think that's been incredibly exciting as well.
All right, Nicola.
I mean, I'm so lucky because I arrived in Aspen and we have this incredible, you know, monumental building, and it's a real gift. We are also a free museum. It's free entry and we have a free education program. So we feel very passionate about how we interact with our public. You know, Jonathan Berger and I were talking about this a lot over the summer, but we're talking about monumentality as something that isn't necessarily something that you can see or touch necessarily or even own. And as much as we're trying to become more sophisticated in how we measure things, I think we want everything we do to have surprises and unknowns. So we want to take risks. We want to have a space where we can have the conversations. And with this exhibition, in many ways, the conversation's only just beginning.
Last question is for Monica. We were talking earlier about there's no way to answer the question of like, what's your favorite piece, and we won't go down that road. But I am interested in choices, and I'm interested in first impressions. And when you go into this exhibition, you're greeted with an image of Warhol's mother and a video. And that was obviously a quite important decision. Just to end, talk about why that was important to begin with.
The decision to begin with Warhol's mother, I think that one of the most extraordinary things and moving things about Warhol was that he had this very unusual relationship with his mother. The fact that they were collaborators when he was a commercial artist was really fascinating for me to really fully understand. The fact that they lived together, you know, until a year before her death, and all of these various ways in which his family was so very important to him. You know, there's a huge emphasis on his mother in the opening of the exhibition. And in a certain way, it was one of the things that I felt would really personalize Warhol for people. And even the images of him as a boy, their family story, the poverty, you know, in a sense, that's basically his worldview, you know, shaped by his childhood, obviously. And I felt that it would help people maybe in a way to feel a sense of relationship to Warhol. That was very important to me. In a way, to have a new image of Warhol, to feel a sense of maybe almost a kind of protectiveness towards him. Of course, his mother was incredibly important, and we were very fortunate to have the mother from the Liechtenstein. That was something that we brought in. And also this amazing video of her. Again, he filmed his mother, and she would sort of partake in these studio experiments, these studio works that he was doing, and that actual work where she's herself, but acting as the wife, I guess, or the lover of this young man, acting as an old man. But I wanted her voice, and I wanted her visage. I wanted everything there in the foreground. And his relationship to religion, of course, was really through her. So their shared bond was very important to me. I really felt like her portrait was really exceptionally different than the other portraits, that he had made it really for himself, which was very important to me. He made it 2 years after her death. So I just felt like it all kind of came together. It should be the mother that opens the exhibition.
If I could be anything in the world that flew, I would be a bat and come swooping after you.
In the early 1980s, a few years before his untimely death in 1987, quintessential New Yorker Andy Warhol purchased 40 acres of land just outside of Aspen. Warhol would wander around, a fur hat on his head, camera always around his neck, documenting the daily goings-on. In reference to Aspen, he wrote, "When you leave the city and go out in the country, you're always tempted to think, this is the real America. The air smells so great, and the land with nothing on it looks so peaceful. And you remember all the wonderful things about being away from town with everything quiet and calm for a change."
If I could be any one of the things in this world that bite, instead of a dentured ocelot on a leash, I'd rather be a kite and be tied to the end of your string and flying in the air, babe, at night.
Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Theme music by Broncho. For more on the museum and the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.
The cheap bloodsuckers are flying after you. Yesterday, Daisy May and Biff were grooving on the street. And just like in a movie.